This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. The disaster in Houston has filled recent headlines, but the division within the United States that was in the headlines so much before Hurricane Harvey hit is not going away. We need to keep a close eye on the protests, the violence, and the rioting that are increasing within America, because there are some extremely alarming prophecies in the Bible showing that social breakdown is going to be intense and very destructive. We're going to talk with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about the Antifa movement. We'll learn about this group's roots. We'll see how it contains the seeds of a serious social crisis in America. Iran's influence in Syria and Lebanon has been growing. We've been talking about that on recent programs. Well, this week, Israel began to mount something of a response. It started drills for a mock war against the Hezbollah terrorist group in northern Israel. This is the Israeli Defense Force's largest exercise in nearly 20 years. Tensions are clearly heating up in this crucial part of the world. We're going to talk about this with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal. Chronic disease is responsible for almost two-thirds of deaths in the world. This is non-communicable diseases like cancer, diabetes, cardiovascular disease. Can we prevent these diseases? There's a problem with the way that modern medicine deals with them, and we're essentially trying to treat the effects rather than the causes of these diseases. We'll talk with personal trainer and holistic nutritionist Jörg Mardian about this problem and what we can do to reduce our risk for these chronic diseases. And finally, we're going to talk about a really bad reason to do physical exercise. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. We've just sent our newest edition of the Trumpet Magazine off to the printer. The opening article from the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, is "Charlottesville Violence, The Real Danger is Invisible." It's a very important article. I encourage you to go to thetrumpet.com and read that. It should be up there soon if it isn't already. But Mr. Fleury goes back to Abraham Lincoln's House Divided speech, and he makes the point that America's division, the division that you see so rampant in America today, is far more dangerous than people are acknowledging. He actually compares conditions today to those preceding the Civil War and says in some ways it's even more dangerous today. What we see very specifically and what we're going to talk about in this segment is the radically racially charged standoff between white nationalist groups on one side and these radical leftist groups like Antifa on the other. And looking at this from the standpoint of biblical prophecy, you realize this problem is not going away. It's going to get a lot more dangerous, a lot more deadly with time. So it's very important that we watch this trend closely. To talk about it, we have trumpet writer Andrew Miller. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
So we were talking about this on our Week in Review program last Friday, and we were discussing specifically the Antifa protest that happened in Berkeley. Catch us up to speed with what we learned at that protest.
Right, because this Antifa protest in Berkeley really does expose the danger of how this division you see in America could spiral out of control. Now, a couple weeks before, as you mentioned, you had the violence in Charlottesville with you had like the Antifa protesters on one side and these white nationalists on the other side. And a lot of people were just pointing out that like, okay, well, there's like 6,000 Ku Klux Klan members in the United States and maybe a few thousand Antifa members. So these are some fairly violent fringes. But then in Berkeley, you actually saw where they had a no to Marxism in America rally. It was organized by a group called Patriots Prayer. The organizers were actually a Japanese American and a transgendered person, so not your typical white nationalist fascist group here. And they're basically protesting for free speech and defending the First Amendment. But they're The No Marxism protest officially was canceled over concerns over public safety, but a few dozen people showed up anyway, where they were met with about 2,000 counter-protesters. And then almost 100 Antifa protesters had actually, like, pushed past the police, jumped over a concrete barricade, and started beating this anti-Marxist protesters. And there were chants like no Trump, no KKK, no fascist USA.
Yeah, I actually saw something that said no USA, period. Like, one of the chants that they were saying, it was basically an anti-American chant.
Right, because it was the other one that said like, no Trump, no wall, no USA at all.
Right.
Just saying that they're just wanting, like, against the concept of America as a nation state.
Right.
But even this first chant, it's almost kind of ironic, is that if you were to take it literally, it's a correct chant. No Trump, there was no Trump at that rally. No KKK, no KKK members were at that rally. And no fascist USA, there were no fascists at this rally. This wasn't Charlottesville, where you have Antifa members facing off against white nationalists. This is Antifa members just facing off against people protesting for free speech and against Marxism. There was no white nationalist on the other side. But it does just really bring out kind of what Antifa's strategy is. Now, because the original Antifa was founded in 1931 as the military arm of the Communist Party of Germany. It made its name fighting with the Nazis in the streets of the Weimar Republic. Hitler banned it, obviously, after coming to power, and it kind of came back into existence in the 80s to initially protest against neo-Nazism. But it is still a communist organization whose original goal was to establish a communist dictatorship in Germany. And today, even if you look at, like, the Antifa handbook, it talks about the police are our enemy. It talks about capitalism being our enemy.
Well, now, where do you find the Antifa handbook? Right. Is this available online?
I'm sure it is. I saw a news article actually summarizing that, where it was just talking, and then there was another news article where it was talking about this conference that they had with another linked organization, just kind of giving, like, guidelines to people who are organizing protests. And it's talking about that this is these are planned protests against the police, against capitalist, against free speech advocates, and against KKK members as well. But that is really their strategy, is that they're lumping pretty much anyone who defends the Constitution or capitalism as a right-wing fascist.
Well, it's just remarkable to me you're talking about some fairly unsavory links with this group in its past. And yet, if you look at the chants that we're hearing at these rallies, in some ways they're being pretty open about what their aims are. And I just wonder how publicly available this information is, if they're putting out a tract that's explaining what their basic policies and their recommendations for America's future are. You would think that there would be a whole lot more people looking at this group and saying, well, now, wait a minute, this is not just some fringe group that we don't really need to be concerned about. I mean, they're showing up at rallies well armed. They're well funded. They're well organized. There's a lot here to be concerned about.
Right. This is something that, I mean, that's their strategy, is that if you can like slur or smear all Republicans as racist, I mean, that's a recruitment drive for them. And there's even some, I saw an interview on CNN with Michael Moore, famous liberal
documentarian.
Where he's talking about, he said, hey, if you're he actually, I mean, this is kind of an extreme example, I'm almost loath to bring it up, but he's talking about, he said, someone who holds a woman down to be raped is just as complicit as the rapist, and was comparing people who voted for Donald Trump to those enablers. He's like,
wow.
He said, Trump's the racist fascist who's destroying this nation, but he said anyone who's voted for him is like the person holding America down. And this is broadcasting on CNN, which is a very mainstream news network.
I mean,
just really buying into this Antifa narrative that if you can get enough people to believe that the president's no different from a KKK member, I mean, you can get him ousted from office. And that is also another big thing, is not Antifa particularly, but you almost have to wonder with these rallies. I mean, people like to talk about protests like they're like an organics grassroots things, like, well, I'm so mad that I'm going to run to Walgreens and paint a sign and go to this place and start yelling. And lo and behold, 10,000 other people had the same idea. But I mean, it's obviously logistically someone's got to tell protesters, when are we going to meet? Where are we going to meet? Who's going to make the signs? Who's going to bring the sandwiches? Whatever else you need for this. And you'll see a lot of these protests, especially at Berkeley, across the nation, have been planned by an organization called Refuse Fascism. And they've got a website publicly available, Refuse Fascism. And they're saying their stated goal is to discredit both Donald Trump and Mike Pence domestically and internationally. In an attempt to get them ousted from office, they're actually planning a series of rallies for November 4th. So, I mean, that's also shaping up to probably be a fairly violent day here in the months ahead.
So let's just talk about this in terms of looking at it from the standpoint of biblical prophecy. And this is what we were really just didn't have time to get into when we were talking about this last Friday. But when you have what are the prophecies that we're looking at that would cause us to really take a very close interest in what Antifa is accomplishing here?
Right. Well, there are a number of prophecies, but probably the most direct ones are going to come from Ezekiel 5. And we've got a chapter in our editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury's Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet booklet. It's chapters 4 and 5 in particular that talk about the violence, and it goes through Ezekiel 5 in details and talks about how God had asked Ezekiel to do a strange thing, where he shaved off all his hair and he divided it equally into 3 parts, and he burnt one part, and then he chopped the other part up with a sword, and then he threw the other part into the wind. And it was a prophecy of what would happen to end time Israel, which our longtime listeners will know as end time America and end time Britain, that a third of them would be destroyed in like civil rioting, civil violence, civil turmoil. Another third would be taken away captive when a foreign power invaded in the wake of that civil war. And then the last third would end up slaves to that foreign captor. And the book describes this in much more detail, but it's specifically that first third that's burnt with the fire. It says pestilence, actually, fire and pestilence in Ezekiel, but the book does a pretty detailed Hebrew word study showing that that's talking about the types of things that happen in natural disasters like Hurricane Harvey, the type of things that happen in terrorist attacks like the 9/11 attack, and the type of this like rioting, civil rioting, like you've seen in Berkeley and Charlottesville. Actually, there's one quote I can take from the booklet here. This is actually on page 46, where it says, "The United States and Britain are going to be left out in the cold as two gigantic trade blocs, Europe and Asia, mesh together and begin calling the shots in world commerce. The nations of Israel are going to be literally besieged and economically frozen out of world trade. But as this happens, domestic rioting and violence will become much more prevalent. Already in America today, instances of rioting and burning are occurring much more regularly, often associated with racial hatred." And that's something. This book was recently updated, but
the material that you were just reading was from what, probably about 15 years ago would be my guess.
Yeah, the original version came out in 2002, so yeah, about exactly 15 years ago. And if those paragraphs have been edited at all, you can see from the older version that it is something that it is something that we've been saying for since the original draft 15 years ago about rioting and terrorism and race riots. And now it's kind of easy to see that those things all around you. But back in 2002, I mean, I guess 9/11 had just happened, but you didn't have the race tensions like you have today.
No. Yeah. I actually remember all that time ago, we were talking about it in the context of Los Angeles rioting. There was burning in Los Angeles at that time. That was a cover on the Trumpet magazine back in, I think that was 1991. And Mr. Fleury was pointing to these prophecies that were just talking about the cities in particular within the United States and Britain descending into a kind of violence and burning on a massive scale. And what we've seen, it's just been this, like, every incident that takes place that's kind of along these lines just seemed like it's setting another paving stone for this massive explosion within the United States. And here you have these groups that are determinedly going after, you know, so there's somebody, a group that's going to protest free speech, or they're trying to support free speech. They are organizing and going after them, and they're coming at it from the standpoint of trying to create as much violence and havoc as possible. It doesn't necessarily take a huge number of people to cause a tremendous amount of damage, and it seems like there's also this sort of momentum that's getting behind some of these groups, and some of them also seem to be joining with other related groups that have similar revolution type goals. So you have this momentum that's building behind a very violent movement within this country. Right.
And there is a direct connection all the way back to those LA riots. There's one member, fairly famous now, social agitator, Carl Dix is his name, but he's the co-founder of the Revolutionary Communist Party USA, and they split with the Normal Communist Party USA because the Normal Communist Party wanted to use more of a policy of cooperation with the Democratic Party to push America further left, while the Revolutionary Communist Party wanted a violent revolution to establish a Maoist dictatorship that would encompass all of North America. A small group, less than 2,000 people. But Carl Dix, he was one of the members that he was making. He wrote a pamphlet called It's Right to Rebel that he distributed during those LA riots to try to get people in the streets. Mm. And in the years since then, he was at the Ferguson, Missouri protest a couple years ago. He was at the Baltimore, Maryland protest a couple years ago. Along with Cornel West, he's actually now the co-founder of this Refuse Fascism organization that's been organizing and making the signs for these riots at Berkeley and other places. And like I said, this stated goal is to oust President Trump and Vice President Pence from power using riots and even though or using protest. I mean, they say the Refuse Fascism say they want nonviolent protest, and the Antifa just shows up anyway. Though it is interesting to note that the guy who founded the organization is moonlighting as a member of the Revolutionary Communist Party USA, which is much more open that there needs to be a violent revolution in America. So he's talking out of both sides of his mouth there. But it does show that, I mean, all these race riots, I mean, as there is an invisible spirit mm-hmm. behind it. This is prophetic. This is like the devil's attempt to sow discord in America. But there is also some of these groups that are at least making the signs and organizing these protests have been involved in almost every major protest from the LA riots all the way up to what we saw in Berkeley a week and a half ago.
Well, you can find this article by Gerald Fleury, Charlottesville Violence, The Real Danger is Invisible. And he talks quite a lot in this article about that spirit dimension to, as you were just describing, the fact that it's not just people who are making these decisions, that there is actually a malevolent spirit behind what's happening here. And he proves that from the Bible. Really important article to read. Go online to thetrumpet.com and find that and read it. And also, just to circle back to that Ezekiel booklet, this is available at thetrumpet.com. If you just go under the literature tab and you look at books and booklets, Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet, chapter 4 is called Terrorism and Race Riots, chapter 5, Superpower Under Siege, describing these really electrifying prophecies from Ezekiel that show just how widespread the damage from these riots that we're seeing now are going to get in this country. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller. He's working on an article about this as well for thetrumpet.com, so watch for that. Andrew, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
As we have discussed on recent programs, Iran's influence in Syria and Lebanon has been growing. It's increasing its presence on Israel's northern border, and it seems to be reviving its ambition to attack Jerusalem. Well, this week we saw Israel begin to mount something of a response. It started drills for a mock war against the Hezbollah terrorist group in northern Israel. This is the Israeli Defense Force's largest exercise in nearly 20 years. It really does look like events are leading toward war. How serious is this situation? To talk about this, we have from our office in Jerusalem, Trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall. Hello, Brent.
Hello.
We talked about this last Friday. Maybe you could just bring us up to speed on what Iran has been up to that is such a cause for concern here.
There's a couple of things to think about in this regard. Well, three, really. We talked a bit on the program last week about Hamas's restored ties with Iran. Of course, Hamas isn't in Lebanon or even in Syria. Hamas is based in the Gaza Strip. But they are talking now about how the relationship with Iran is back to top notch. Iran is the largest financial and military backer of Hamas right now. That's what the leader said of Hamas in the Gaza Strip just last week. So we have that angle threat for Israel. And then you also have what's been taking place in Syria. Obviously, the Islamic State has lost a lot of ground in Syria over the past year and a half. And right now, it looks like the Islamic State's verging on defeat in the eastern part of Syria. The last of the Islamic State soldiers on the Lebanese-Syrian border just got transported and moved towards eastern Syria this last week in a deal with Hezbollah and Iran. They basically said, you get out of this territory along the Lebanese border, and you can have free passage all the way back to close to Raqqa in eastern Syria. So Iran is firmly in control now of western Syria as that gets close to the Israeli border on the Israeli Golan Heights. The area to the southwest of Damascus, as you get down towards the Golan Heights, you have Shiite militias backed by Iran who take orders from Iran, activated in that area, using that area as a greater potential threat against Israel. And then you have the thought that as the Syrian civil war winds down, as Hezbollah isn't used as much to preserve the dictatorship of Bashar al-Assad, that those Hezbollah fighters are going to be returning back to Lebanon, thousands of them, I think it's about 10,000 Hezbollah fighters fighting in Syria right now, much more equipped with Iranian weaponry if they can get it across the border, if Israel lets them do that, but with the strategic know-how to fight a ground offensive that's been very successful for them in Syria, and Israel is worried that they are going to try and use their newfound tactics against Israel in northern Israel.
Okay, so Israel making a pretty strong statement this week with these drills that it has begun. Just tell us about what Israel's up to here.
Yeah, as you said at the beginning, these are the largest drills in the past 20 years, and they're focused in the very northern part of Israel. Tens of thousands of soldiers are being included in these, as well as thousands of reservists as well. So they've been called up for this. The reservists have been called up for this 10-day trial, this 10-day drill. It uses the Air Force. It's using intelligence, different intelligence parts of the military. It's using the Navy as well. And it's basically preparing for a Hezbollah ground assault into northern Israel. This is an article from the Times of Israel. They say that this exercise will simulate a conflict with Hezbollah that starts with a sudden small attack and develops into a full-scale war. The official said the military's goal in the drill was to vanquish the terrorist group. So they are they're also incorporating as part of this their Operation Safe Distance plan. This is the Israeli military, whereby I think we've talked about this a few months ago, whereby the villages and towns in the very northern parts of Israel will be forced to evacuate by the Israeli military, pushed south a number of kilometers, probably 30 kilometers from the border, removed by the military, saying, you are no longer safe. We cannot protect you. You need to get back behind our defensive line. Already giving over these towns to the Hezbollah infiltration. So there are going to be some towns over the next few days in Israel that are going to be evacuated. We don't know exactly which ones they're going to be, but that will happen in northern Israel, the military says. So they're preparing for every single the great likelihood that Hezbollah actually tries this with their soldiers.
So put this in context for us, Brent. Obviously, there have been two other wars that Israel has fought, particularly with Hezbollah as the primary enemy in Lebanon. And we've seen a lot of action up there but it's been some time. I mean, this what strikes me about this is that in some ways the northern frontier of Israel has been relatively quiet for quite a while as Syria and other battlegrounds have kind of taken up the space for a group like Hezbollah. Now that's quieting down, Syria's quieting down, and this is heating back up, and it's like Israel is kind of back into response crisis mode in dealing with this.
Right. So this Lebanese threat has been there for a while, as you mentioned. You had the first Lebanon war in 82. That was more against the Palestinian groups. The PLO was in southern Lebanon. And then Israel, after largely being successful in that, they took up the territory south of Beirut all the way down to the Israeli border. Israeli troops were stationed there. Israel finally withdrew under Ehud Barak in 2000 from that territory all the way to the current border where it exists right now. But under condition that area south of the Litani River would not be used as a terrorist safe haven for groups that had since come along, such as Hezbollah. So after Hezbollah took up their posts after 2000, the next war that broke out took place in 2006, and that was directly against Hezbollah. They didn't leave that territory, or they actually used a lot of the houses as weapons depots, and they fired, as we've seen Hamas do from the Gaza Strip, from residential areas, to the point that Israel had a ground invasion for a month long. But it was very difficult for the Israeli soldiers, commandos, going street to street, town to town, house to house, to rid Hezbollah from that territory. And basically they withdrew after 30 days, facing increasing international pressure with a stalemate, which was meant to see, again, UNIFIL, this observer force from the UN, ensure that Hezbollah couldn't take up arms in that territory. And yet they've done so to the point now that the threat that exists from Hezbollah, as far as their missile caches that they have, their stash, over 100,000 missiles, the 2006 war would pale in comparison to how devastating a Hezbollah attack on Israel would be, because they've used this past decade to actually grow and grow and grow in power.
Well, yeah, that's 100,000 missiles. Like, if we're comparing where we are today to where we were 10, 11 years ago, it seems like Hezbollah learned some lessons from what happened there. And what was the trumpet saying at that time in terms of what we could expect to see going forward? And where are we today relative to what we were saying at that time?
Right. So we talked about in 2006, that was a big year. It was also the time when and this might have been the reason that we've had some peace for the past decade. It's because that was the time that Hezbollah decided to go, venture into the public sphere away from overt military actions against Israel for the time being, because they began to be part of the Lebanese government. And we said at the time, when the world celebrated that the Syrian government was leaving Lebanon, that democracy is coming to Lebanon. This is going to be wonderful. That's what the world said. But the trumpet, we said back then that Iran was going to take over Lebanon. Iran is going to take over Lebanon through its proxy Hezbollah. And that's what has happened since, hamstrung in the government for a number of years. Hezbollah has, to the point now that it has a third of the posts in the cabinet, really just making it difficult for the other Lebanese citizens to break out of this cycle of violence as well that a lot of them don't want. So what we've said is that ever since the 2006 war, and even before that, just the way that Israel does fight its wars, and even looking back before the time of the Lebanese war, or the three wars that we've had in the Gaza Strip as well since 2008, we don't see any clear victories. No matter what Israel does, no matter the growing strength that Israel has, no matter how many F-35s they get from the United States, or David Sling, or Iron Dome, or Arrow, the Arrow system that's just come online, or the David Sling just come online to try and counter these rockets coming down, they haven't been able to have a clear victory, clear victories that they saw at the start of their statehood. If you go back to 48, 67, or even the Yom Kippur War, there were just amazing miracles that took place to give Israel victories. And if I was an Israeli citizen, I would be asking the question, if we have all this increased firepower, why do we live under a constant threat of war that only ever seems to be increasing?
So, yeah, that is the question, isn't it? What lesson can we take from this if we're looking at the predicament that Israel is in, and just looking at it from the standpoint of Bible prophecy? Here they are planning for yet another war on their northern frontier. What lessons can Israel take from this?
Well, Bible prophecy is kind of clear that what's going to happen here, it might not, another Lebanese war won't happen. But as we've seen, and even as our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory's book, Jerusalem in Prophecy, brings out, there is this growing sense of Israel's in Israel as a search for a man-made solution to this crisis. And that is in turn going to even lead Israel to rely on foreign allies such as Europe and Germany eventually. That's what the Bible indicates. Rather than looking back at their history and looking where the people's hope was, and the people's hope, they knew that they couldn't win these victories by themselves. They had to trust in the God that did give them a state. Go back to 1948, 1967, read some of the reports, even in the left-leaning Haaretz newspaper. And they said at the time, there's no explanation for this but a miracle, a miracle. Even if you don't believe in God, you have to admit that this was a miracle. And so God was for the state of Israel at some point. Israel hasn't really won a war decisively since that time. So, I mean, Israel, there is hope for you, but you have to look back at that very special, intimate history that you've actually had with God.
So you said that the indication is that there wouldn't be another Lebanon war. I wonder about that, because it does seem like the pressure that Israel is experiencing, particularly at the hand of Iran, that is really in keeping with what we expect in prophecy, and that it wouldn't necessarily be contradictory to that expectation if something did flare up into a hot war on Israel's northern border.
Yeah, what I meant to say is Bible prophecy doesn't indicate one way or another whether there will be a new Lebanese war. But it would make sense, just looking at it, that it actually would happen, as you're saying, because of the Iranian angle to this question and the desire that they have to reach Jerusalem, to put Israel as a nation under threat, and Hezbollah being the sharpest tool that they have in their arsenal to do that with, makes sense that they would try and motivate them for such an attack. So I don't want to do away with the potential for that happening, but Bible prophecy doesn't indicate it's going to be the thing that brings them down ultimately.
So to put all of this in perspective, if someone were interested in more information about what to expect in Jerusalem and just looking at what lies ahead in Israel's future, where should they go?
I would definitely request the booklet I referred to earlier, Jerusalem in Prophecy. I think it's about 65 to 75 pages in length. It's not too big, but it definitely lays out the timeline of end time events that the state of Israel can expect. But it also looks back at history as well goes through some really important history for 60s and 70s and 80s that I think Israeli citizens would really look at and have to ask some tough questions and agree with for most of that as well. But yes, that book, Jerusalem and Prophecy, by Gerard Flory, will help you out.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal. In addition to the booklet that he just recommended, you can also just go online to thetrumpet.com. That's where you can find that book if you just go under the literature tab there. But you'll also see an article here within the next day or two from Brent on this subject. He's working on that now. So go to thetrumpet.com and check it out. Thanks for your time, Brent.
No problem.
Is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
As the world's population pushes toward 8 billion people, the number of deaths from chronic disease is rapidly rising. These are non-communicable diseases. They represent 63% of all deaths, and they snuff out prime years of productive life in half of those who get them. Modern medicine says we're winning the battle with chronic disease, but statistics suggest otherwise. Can we prevent these diseases? Well, a big part of the problem is that we tend to treat the effects rather than the causes. This was something Herbert W. Armstrong talked a lot about as a major problem with our modern world, a major factor why we can't solve our escalating problems. To talk about this, we have from his office in British Columbia, personal trainer and holistic nutritionist, Jorg Mardian. Hello, Jorg.
Hi there. How are you?
Doing quite well. So chronic disease, this isn't necessarily a term that is used commonly. What are we talking about? What are the main kinds of chronic diseases?
Sure. Well, chronic disease can also be defined as an NCD, so a non-communicable disease. And the medical profession will say it's of a long duration and slow progression. So, and these are quite common. I mean, if you look at it worldwide, about 40 million people are affected a year, you know, and that's, I think that's the equivalent of about 70% of all global deaths. Mm. It's not a small problem. So there's four main types of NCDs: cancer, cardiovascular disease, chronic respiratory diseases, and diabetes. So those are the four big guns, and they're said to disproportionately affect older people. But you know that's no longer true because about 15 million NCD-related deaths are now shifting to younger people. So there's a concerning pattern veering towards that younger generation. And, you know, one of the more disheartening effects is that children are becoming affected with a lower life expectancy. So there is a saying that our children may not outlive their parents. I'm not sure if that's true, but, you know, the pattern is certainly shifting towards us getting disease at a younger and younger age. And this is going to take away from this expected life, the life expectancy that we have. It's, you know, they want it to go on to 120, 130 years.
Right. Well, it's certainly been rising over several generations. Life expectancy, that's really one of the major reasons why population has grown as much as it has in the last 100, 200 years. Life expectancy is rising. And so a turnaround in that is quite a dramatic shift.
Oh, absolutely. You know, adding urgency to that debate is the likelihood that the number of people affected by chronic disease is going to rise in the coming decades. So we keep saying we're going to live longer and we're going to live longer. But that's directly opposite of what the UN says, the United Nations. It says there's approximately 2 billion more people that are going to die globally by 2050. You have to think about that, 2 billion people. Hmm. So economically, it's going to be staggering as well because of the five of the top diseases are going to cost the global economy somewhere around $47 trillion annually. Now, these are numbers that we can't even comprehend. And I think Margaret Chan, she used to be the director general of the World Health Organization. She said these are diseases that tax health systems to the breaking point and that break the bank. Right. It's no small problem.
Yeah. So it seems like the way that you're talking about the diseases that you were just describing, diabetes, cancer, cardiovascular problems, that these are things that we understand a certain amount of what causes these, that we've identified several risk factors and things that tend to exacerbate or cause these problems. But I guess the question is that really what the medical community is going after, and how much are people making the lifestyle changes in order to avoid getting into these problems, and how much of medical intervention is more about just trying to deal with the effects after somebody has procured one of these diseases?
Sure. That's a great question. And it's somewhat like a seesaw. We know that these diseases have a cause, specific and identifiable. And the four main risk factors for these diseases are unhealthy diet, physical inactivity, tobacco, and alcohol use. So those are the four big ones that they've been identified. And the UN knows that. But the thing is, you know, you were asking about healthcare, and there's the seesaw effect. Is healthcare the answer to this? Well, what are we doing? We're identifying the risk factors, but we're not going after them. We're not chasing them. What we're doing is we're chasing the effect. So if I have a headache, I can take a pill. I can choose to take a pill, or I can choose to see what's causing my headache. Mm-hmm. In this world today, in a medical society, it's only looking at what we can take and then knock it down as quickly as possible with a pharmaceutical agent. That's the thing. So we can actually treat diseases pretty good. So we can say manage cancer at 65, right? We can persist with a heart disease at 75, taking all these cocktails of drugs. We can regulate Alzheimer's to a degree at 85. But here's the question. What are we doing to ourselves? What kind of life are we leading? I mean, when you're looking at the deteriorating life of illness, of pain, of disability, I mean, we're ignoring the cause, and more people develop diseases. And in the future, these hospitals are just going to overrun with patients who we're managing. This isn't a way to lead a life. And the struggle is painted as progress. I mean, we're saying, well, we're doing so good, we're helping people live longer. But what it resembles really is World War I trench warfare. Hmm. You know, despite our medical advances, despite the untold billions that are invested, the research and the science behind it, it's a fact that 7 of the top 10 diseases today continue to be chronic diseases. And not only that, they're going to kill us more times than modern medicine can effectively intervene. We're not winning the war because we're looking at it backwards. The tail is effectively wagging the dog.
Yeah, it does seem like the promise of medical science is that they can handle any given situation. That seems to be the notion that has embedded itself within the minds of a lot of people. You get cancer, you go, you get it treated. I mean, if you see a commercial on television for a cancer clinic, you know, they say this is one of the best in the country, and you know, you every day from the time you get that diagnosis, you're a survivor, and we can essentially promise you that you're going to be able to conquer this. Where in many cases with these diseases, there is a reality when the body is being besieged by a chronic disease like this, that science medicine. It's against that reality. And in a lot of cases, as those statistics that you brought out demonstrate very forcefully, it's a losing battle. There is only so much that science can do once someone gets that disease. So, and I'm just thinking, listening to you talk about just the costs involved and so on, it doesn't necessarily benefit the medical community to keep someone healthy. They earn a lot of money on, say, putting someone through chemotherapy or whatever, intensive treatments that they may offer to someone. That's where they make their money. So there is incentive to treating effect where there isn't necessarily, apart from just, you know, one person trying to take care of another person, to treat causes.
Well, that is true. And I like the term you used, you know, we're being besieged by disease. And at the same time, we're also being abused by the system with these pharmaceutical agents. And the reason that chronic disease rates can't fall, there's three big reasons, and like you were identifying there. Drugs do not address cause. They can't. They can only address the effect. The second would be big business thrives on illness. You were mentioning that too. It thrives on the having people sick, and there's a lot of money involved. And then the third reason is only a small percentage of healthcare costs are slotted for the prevention of disease. Mm-hmm. You put those three together, and simply what it does is it feeds the system. It's a big machine that feeds itself, and there's just no way to turn that around anymore. If you take away the system, I mean, the economy would fall into itself, cave in. It's based upon the pharmaceutical industry and trillions of dollars going through that. And unfortunately, disease is big business, and we're not looking at it and saying, look, we're trying to shout from the rooftops with this. It's an obvious thing. You go to your doctor and you say, I have a problem. Within 30 seconds, you're given a prescription. It's that quick now. We're not being asked, what is the cause? Can we give you a diet to change anything? Can we recommend some exercise for you? That just almost doesn't exist anymore. It's just, here we go. Here's a prescription. This stuff really works. You'll like it. And in 2 weeks, I've got two more problems because of the side effects.
Yeah, just thinking about we're kind of running out of time here, but you were talking about just how much these problems are spreading globally, and in some ways, it seems like the lifestyle choices that we have embraced within the West, that we've kind of exported those to a lot of countries, to where these diseases, those big four that you were talking about, it's in some ways it's been kind of incubated within Western nations, the diet, the inactivity, and those other risk factors that you identified. And the fact that it's spreading is proof that we do know what causes these diseases.
Absolutely. We used to call it a quintessential American disease, chronic disease. It's now a global pandemic. I mean, Nestle is sailing a supermarket barge down the Amazon River, selling chocolate bars in small amounts to people making $2 a day. We're exporting the worst of our habits. And really, if you look at a company like Nestle, they want to do half of their business in a developing world in 10 years. That's a staggering change, a turnaround. And the developing world now has 80% of these chronic diseases already. Mm. So we want to make sure that they stay ahead of us, you know, if for the sake of money. And that's really what it is. The whole world is now affected.
Well, let's just finish by talking about prevention. And how much can a person take matters into his own hands in trying to keep himself free from these chronic diseases?
We live in a poison world. Everything we touch, you know, whether you put it on your body, whether you use a shampoo, whether you ingest it, it's poisoned. You really have to take care to lead a life of moderation and quality. So, and Mr. Armstrong always said, you know, if eat natural foods, eat foods that you can put on a counter and you see them spoil. And that is a food that's going to keep you healthy. You know, what we suffer from today is largely preventable. So what we have to do is we have to act on that and make sure that we change, make changes in our life with making sure that we do get out and move, making sure that we do eat good, get sunshine, fresh air, make sure you don't stress so much and get plenty of sleep. That's a life of moderation, and we can't turn a blind eye and go in a supermarket and just buy stuff. We have to take care to make sure that we eat healthy and that we move and we lead that life of moderation.
Well, excellent, excellent information. We've been talking with Jörg Mardian about chronic disease. He's working on an article on the subject. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. We appreciate your generosity with your expertise there, Jörg, and always appreciate your time.
Thank you for your time.
It's time for today's last word.
You've probably heard you should exercise. Exercise is important for health. It has a lot of great benefits. But guess what? Many, many people exercise for the wrong reason. Here's a basic truth. There are two ways of life, give and get. The way of give is outflowing. The way of get is incoming. The first way is concern for others. The latter is concern for self. One way is love, the other is vanity. Some things are obviously the way of get: abusing alcohol or drugs, gluttony, arrogant trash talk. Other things require true discernment to tell the difference. Music can be uplifting and godly or evil. A positive hobby can turn into an unhealthy obsession. A person might perform a helpful service, but with selfish motives. You may do the right thing, but for utterly wrong reasons that actually express vanity. For many people, exercise is vanity. Society exalts and worships sports stars for their physical skills, regardless of their morals or their character. People become unwholesomely fixated on personal fitness, chasing greater speed, skill, or strength. People grow intensely focused on themselves at the obvious expense of God and other people. Many people focus on body image in unhealthy ways. Airbrushed images are everywhere of what you're supposed to look like, causing a lot of people to be dissatisfied with normal. Many people hate aspects of their appearance the way God made them simply because they don't match certain societal standards of beauty or handsomeness. Being healthier does tend to be more attractive, but many of the models of human bodies that are being glorified have no correlation with health, and trying to live up to them is preposterous. People value thinness or bulkiness over health. They diet, they starve, they get eating disorders, they train for looks rather than function, they preen and flex and take pictures of themselves in the mirror, they take drugs, they go under the knife to remove fat or stretch skin, they inject themselves with poisons, they insert implants, whatever it takes to achieve that look. Vanity is sin, and this world is loaded with it. And so much of that vanity revolves around appearance. Has this affected your thinking? The real source of these unhealthy ideas is revealed in the Bible as the devil. Here's how God describes this being in the book of Ezekiel. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. It's easy for us to fall into the same trap, especially because the devil is actively trying to pull us into that kind of thinking. You do need to exercise, but don't exercise so you can admire yourself in the mirror. Don't do it so you can look better at the swimming pool. Don't do it to stoke your vanity. You already have too much vanity. This physical life, everything we work for, get excited about, pour our energies into, is vanity if it's not connected to our spiritual purpose. exercise, sports, the NBA, coffee, the Food Network, the latest movie, literature, music, whatever it is, in and of itself, doesn't amount to anything. You're not on Earth for long. Physical things have the illusion of permanence. We act like they'll last forever, but they don't. And that's certainly true of physical strength and beauty. Just ask the former pageant queen, now in her 60s, or the gifted athlete who sustains a career-ending injury in a split second. Your body is temporary. 1 Peter 1, verse 24 says it's like grass. It sprouts up, looks nice for a little while, then it gets mowed down and returns to dust. But still, many get caught up in the vanities of building their bodies. Some people practically worship these physical bodies. That is pitiful and ridiculous. God gave us our bodies for a purpose, to provide the opportunity to build spiritual character. Everything you do, put it in this context. Is it helping you grow in character? Is it serving others? Does it serve God? Is it leading to eternal life? If not, it really is vanity. And you need to look seriously at cutting it out, or at least making sure it fits snugly into a very tiny corner of your life. Never lose this perspective from 1 Timothy 4, verse 8. It says, "While bodily training or exercise is of some value, godliness is of value in every way, as it holds promise for the present life and also for the life to come." So when you exercise, check yourself in the figurative mirror and make sure you're doing it for the right reasons. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests on today's show, Andrew Miller, Brent Noctegal, and Jörg Mardian. Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. Here's a thought I'll leave you with from Elbert Hubbard. "I'd rather be able to appreciate things I cannot have than to have things I'm not able to appreciate." Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.